think about the last time you had to cancel a subscription. There's probably some waiting on hold, some guessing at your password, some mind-numbing small talk. And maybe, after all of that, you still weren't able to cancel it. Good news, it doesn't have to be this way, thanks to Rocket Money. Rocket Money tracks, manages, and can cancel your subscriptions for you. When you connect your accounts, you'll see a complete picture of all of your recurring subscriptions all in one place. Rocket Money organizes your subscriptions by due date and notifies you when something is coming up, so you'll never be caught off guard when you get charged. If you see a subscription you want to cancel, Rocket Money simplifies the process. Instead of waiting on hold for an hour, you can cancel it right from the app. Rocket Money will even try to get you a refund for the money you spent on subscriptions you forgot about. Stop wasting time trying to cancel subscriptions the hard way. Make your life easier and go to rocketmoney.com/cancel. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel, or download the app from the Apple App or Google Play Stores.
Welcome to Next on the Tee with Chris Mascaro, where tour players, legends, and the top instructors in the game share their stories, insights, and playing lessons. Join Chris every Tuesday night as he talks with the greats of the game. Tonight's show is sponsored by TaylorMade Golf, the PGA Tour Superstore, 2-Under, Golf Pride, Strixon Cleveland Golf. Your best performance starts with the right golf ball. Sun Mountain Golf Bags, Finn Scooters, making the game more fun, Adele Golf, Hit It, Flip It, Dial It In, and the Macklemore Club Experience, Live Above the Clouds. Now, here's your host, Chris Mascaro.
Good evening, folks, and thank you for coming back and joining me on Next on the Tee. I'm your host, Chris Mascaro. Tonight, I've got a really fun trio of guests that I'm looking forward to sharing with you. I've got a tour legend who's the only player to ever shoot 29 on a back nine in U.S. Open history, and he did it twice. You'll meet him shortly. I've got one of the greatest players in LPGA history here with me tonight, and a guy who has done more research into the biomechanics of the golf swing that will help us get a few more miles per hour out of our swings than probably anybody in the business. We'll talk about who those folks are in just a moment. Before we do that, I want to thank all of you again for keeping this show inside the top five of the Podcast Magazine Hot 50 list in the September edition. Your support continues to be amazing. Next on the Tee is currently ranked number 3, and our football show, Thursday Night Tailgate, right behind it at number 5 in the Podcast Magazine Hot 50 list. Our goal, obviously, is to leapfrog both shows into the top 2 spots. So please continue to vote, and you can do so daily by going online to podcastmagazine.com/hot50. Your votes will make a big difference. Thank you so much for taking a moment out of your day to support both shows. It means a great deal to me. Okay, on to tonight's show. First up is going to be former PGA Tour pro Neil Lancaster. Like I mentioned in the teaser, Neil shot a back nine 29 in the 1995 U.S. Open, becoming the first player to ever shoot a 29 on any nine holes in U.S. Open history. And to prove it wasn't a fluke, he came back the very next year, did it again, this time in the second round. We're going to hear both of those amazing stories, plus his win at the 1994 Byron Nelson Classic, plus how he continued to play very well out on the PGA Tour into his 50s. Neil's going to be with me here in just a few minutes. Following him, I'll get a visit from one of the all-time greats on the LPGA Tour, Julie Engster. Julie is 6th all-time in major championship victories with 7. She won 3 consecutive U.S. women's amateur titles early on in her playing career. She won 17 times in college at San Jose State. She captained 2 victorious Solheim Cup teams. She's in the World Golf Hall of Fame, so you know what? We got a couple of things to talk about when she joins me about 25 minutes from now. Then we'll round out tonight's show with a return visit from Chris Finn, the founder of Par for Success. Chris and his team have done some really cool studies on things that we can do to increase our swing speeds and gain a few more yards off the tee. Plus, we can do them at any age. And they've got a great app, so we don't have to go to the gym to do that sort of stuff. We can do the exercises and the drills virtually. So we'll hear all about that when Chris joins me later on in the hour. So there you have it, folks. More great stories, tips, and information are coming your way tonight on this edition of Next on the Tee. So thank you so much for tuning in and taking the journey with me tonight. Before we get started, I want to remind you about our friends up at the Macklemore. As you guys know, My buddies and I were there again this year for our annual golf trip. Second time around, even better than the first. Everything about what they give to you up there is first class. The accommodations are fantastic. The practice facility is great and even greater now after they've opened their Himalayas putting course. The on-premise restaurant called the Craig has outstanding food and service. And to say the course is spectacular is an understatement. Can't say enough great things about it, folks. Go online to themacklemore.com to see how great it is for yourself. The golf course is co-designed by our good friends Bill Bergen and Reese Jones. And our friend and PGA Tour caddy Kip Henley said, outside of Pebble Beach, it's the most beautiful 18th hole he's ever seen. Golf Digest agreed, naming it the best finishing hole in America since 2000. And Lynx Magazine doubled down on that, naming it one of the top 10 finishing holes in all of golf. See why we're all saying such great things by going online to themacklemore.com. And folks, this segment of the show is brought to you by TaylorMade. Golf is an interesting game because the better you hit the ball, the fewer shots you have to hit. That means the better you hit the ball, the less golf you actually have to play. That's why TaylorMade made their all-new Stealth Irons. TaylorMade Stealth Irons feature a cap-back design and a 3D toe wrap designed to help deliver increased distance through the bag and more forgiveness on those occasional, or maybe not so occasional, less than perfect shots. The result? Better shots more often, so you get to have more fun more often. So if you're the kind of golfer who wants to play less golf more often, try the all-new Stealth Irons from TaylorMade, Beyond Driven. Okay, my first guest tonight is Neil Lancaster. Neil is from Smithfield, North Carolina, was a self-taught player who didn't take his first official golf lesson until after he had turned pro. And that lesson was from L.B. Floyd, father of Ray Floyd. We'll talk about that in a minute. Neil turned pro in 1985, got his first win on the PGA Tour in 1994 at the Byron Nelson Classic in a six-man playoff. He finished second in the 2002 Canadian Open. He had five other professional wins at the 1985 Carolinas Open, the 1989 Pine Tree and Utah Opens, the 2017 Carolinas PGA Senior Professional Championship, and the 2018 Carolinas Senior Season Kickoff. He finished tied for fourth at the 1995 U.S. Open at Shinnecock Hills, thanks to a final round 65 that featured a U.S. Open record 29 on the back nine in the final round. He ended up finishing four back of Corey Pavin. He shot a back 929 again the following year in the U.S. Open at Oakland Hills, this time in the second round. Since retiring from playing on the Champions Tour, he's become a PGA professional in the Carolina section, and I'm thrilled to have him with me tonight here on Next on the Tee. Hey, Neil, thanks for coming on the show.
Thanks for having me, Chris. It's a pleasure. It's been hot, but everything's going good. Starting to cool off a little bit. We're going to get through the heat, but it's been a good summer.
Neil, like I mentioned in your intro, you were self-taught. I read that you taught yourself how to play looking at pictures in magazines. So I got to ask, what made you pick up a golf club to begin with? And then how did you teach yourself how to play out of pictures in magazines?
Well, my dad and my granddad used to play all the time. And we had a couple little holes around the house with some, you know, some Maxwell House coffee cans and little irrigation flags. And then we joined a golf course called the Cardinal Golf Club, and they would go out every weekend, so I just ride along with them, and I just started looking at magazines, and was very visual, and would look at people. If I read the articles, I'd get confused, kind of, so I kind of emulate the best players in the world, and at the time, you know, Nicklaus and Trevino, and so I kind of taught myself that way, and I developed a bad hook, and I figured it out myself, and then just, you know, I watched it every Saturday and Sunday afternoon on the tour when Johnny Miller was hot in the day. And I decided that's what I wanted to do. And I just kind of, you know, kept working at it after I got about 15 years old and was lucky enough to make the tour in somewhere around 84, I think. It might have been 81. I don't even know when I got on. But I was, you know, very fortunate to get out there, and I knew what I wanted to do. And I just kind of picked myself. If things went crazy, I just would try to figure out, you know, back then the ball was so different. You could curve it a lot. So I played by feel, and I curved the ball a lot. And I was just a visual guy, and that's basically, and I caught myself.
So at what point, was it 15 when you finally thought to yourself, you know what, hey, I'm pretty good at this thing. I could probably make a run at going pro.
Well, actually, I played all other sports too. And at 15, I started playing. I played baseball, and I was not a very good runner, so I I put my mind to golf and started playing golf in high school, and I just started getting better. The more I played, the better I got. And, you know, and people don't realize it takes a lot of work. I mean, I hit a lot of golf balls figuring it out myself, and sometimes you just got to go out and figure it out yourself.
And like I mentioned in your intro, you didn't take your first official lesson until after you turned pro, and that lesson happened to be from L.B. Floyd, Raymond Floyd's father. So how'd you meet L.B. Floyd, and what made you approach him about taking a lesson?
Well, I actually was, I think I was struggling like my first year on the tour, and I actually didn't regain my status. I mean, I lost my status, and so I thought I'd try to get better, and I was hanging around 140, 132, you know, just never keeping my card the first year. And so I decided to go see Mr. Floyd, who's up the road in Fayetteville, North Carolina, about 50 miles from me, because Ray Floyd, you know, is a legend, and he was still playing good at the time. So I went to see Mr. Floyd, and I'll never forget, I walked in and met him, and he said, I'll be out in a minute. And I got a golf cart, and he got one, and we rode out, and he watched me hit about 15 range balls. And we went out, and he said, I'm going to watch you play three or four holes from a distance. So we went out, and he had a little dog with him in the cart. I'll never forget it. And still was driving the old Cushman three-wheeler. And I hit a few, played like three or four holes, and we came in and went in his office. And I said, well, Mr. Floyd, what do you think? And he said, looks like to me you've got it, son. He said, you got a lot of natural ability. He said, go out there and do it because you've got the talent to do it, is what he told me. So I kind of took that as my lesson. I went out and I retained my playing privileges and got my card back and stayed out there about 14 years before I fell apart again and had to go back to tour school. And then I got through that one and stayed out about three or four more years, and I had some injuries. But he told me probably the greatest thing ever. He said, you're a field player, so, you know, feel it. But back then, the balls and the clubs were so different, you could curve them. And like I said, I was a field player, and I liked to curve the ball. But it gave me a lot of confidence when he told me that I had the talent to go do it, just go do it. So that's what I did.
Speaking of Q school, I read in your PGA Tour profile that at one point you had $93 in your pocket, a van, and that was back in 1989. You still decided to go out there and give it a try on the mini tours. You ended up winning $96,000 in a four-month span and then went on to Q school. Is that accurate?
That is pretty accurate. You know, $93, yeah, I had enough money to get gas. I had a full tank of gas, and, you know, roughly $90 to $100 to get to the first event. And I played good enough to move on to the next one. And what happened, actually, I was a club pro in Mount Olive, North Carolina for 3 years out of college. And the guy who gave me my start, he said, who was the head professional, I was, you know, pretty much beating everybody in the Carolinas. And he said, I think you got some ability. And they got a little bit of money up, and they sent me off. And my dad owned a car lot, and he had a van, and we took it. And so I got enough for my entry fees to play like 14 mini tour tournaments across the country. Well, I played my first one, and when I got to, it was called the U.S. Golf Tour back then. And I got to Texas, and I shot 62 the last day to finish second, and won about $8,500, and that gave me enough money to keep going. And then I went on, and I won another U.S. Golf Tour in Birmingham, Alabama, somewhere behind Three Open. And I won $20,000 there. And then I went to the so I worked my way west to see, because I wanted to see if I could compete against players all over the country. And I got to Utah, and they said Keith Clearwater and J. Don Blake are playing this week, and they got their tour cards. And Keith Clearwater actually was doing them a favor. I think he had won Colonial that year or the year before, shot 64-64 in the last two rounds. So I went out there and played that. I set the tournament record, won it by nine, and won $20,000 there, and drove back, and then that's when I went to tour school that year, and I got through.
Fast forwarding a few years, when you win the Byron Nelson in 1994, they shortened the event to 36 holes due to a lot of rain. Talk about the conditions that week, and then winning the tournament in a six-way playoff.
Well, it was so many rain delays. And I'm always the guy that always loved the locker room because all the characters come out. We always talked and had a good time. So rain delays didn't really bother me. I mean, we just went in and had a good time. And I remember it rained so much on the 14th hole that they took helicopters and drive the fairway out just so we could play the final round. And the Coca-Cola machine was in the middle of the fairway when all the water went away. But anyway, I finished early. I birdied the last five, I think, and then went in a six-man playoff, the largest playoff in history. And the craziest thing is Mark Rolfe. I was the last to hit in the playoff off the tee. And Mark Rolfe said, I have a funny feeling Neil is going to win this thing. And my caddy taught me into, everybody was hitting driver off the tee. It's 18th hole at Las Colinas. And he said, hit a three wood. And the reason he wanted me to hit three wood is because I hit three wood nine iron in regulation. And so I hit three wood and I had the exact same yardage I had in regulation. And I hit it about 5 feet both times. And luckily, you know, you got to have some luck. Everybody missed a putt and I had a 5-footer to win Byron Nelson. You know, it changed my life. Basically, it gave me a lot of confidence and got me in some events I wouldn't have got in. And it was, Byron Nelson, a legend, win his event. And I didn't care if it was 36, a win's a win.
And to that end, when you're getting ready for the six-man playoff, everyone's over on the driving range. They're hitting warm-up shots.
Oh.
I read you hit two shots, went back and sat down because you knew how you were going to play that 18th hole. Is that right?
Yeah, everybody was out there warming up, and you know, everything's TV-based, and everybody's on the range with the caddies hitting balls. I got up, hit a couple. I hit a three-wood first, and I hit a nine-iron second, and then I hit a couple drivers, and I went and sat back down on the bench, and everybody said, Bill, what are you doing? I said, well, we're only going to play one hole. If you don't birdie the first hole, you're going to be out. So I knew if I didn't birdie the first hole, I'd probably be out. And luckily, you know, I just sat down there and put my mind that I'm going to birdie the first hole. That's what happened. I buried the first hole, and everybody else parted, so the tournament was over. But, yeah, I wasn't much of a range rat. I was a, you know, I just, that wasn't my style. I played some of my best golf, and Carlos Franco did this because he's a field player. It's because I'm such a field player and visual that I wouldn't even go to the range because you're just out there hitting straight shots and getting loose. And I would just walk to the tee. First hole's dog leg right. Just hit a little cut shot out there. But that's, you know, golf's a crazy game. We practice on a flat lie, and we only hit it off of a flat lie 18 times all day off the tee box. Most times the ball's below your feet, above your feet. So, you know, on the driving range, you're just hitting off a flat lie and hitting straight shots. And that's good for getting loose, but that has nothing to do with the game, the driving range.
So I got to ask you now, I mean, you're trying to get your first PGA Tour win. You execute the drive, you execute the second shot. Now you've got a 5-footer, and I read it was kind of a downhill putt. You're standing over a 5-footer to win a tournament. Were you nervous? What's going through your mind as you're standing on top of that putt?
Nervous as I've ever been in my life. Luckily, it was 5 foot, and it was downhill left to right, and I could just barely touch it. I think if it was uphill, I probably wouldn't have made the putt, but since it was downhill, I knew that it was really fast, and I really just had to get it started online. And I did, you know, luckily it went in and the hair stood up on my head and just, you know, it was a great feeling. And, you know, guys, that's one thing that I'd like to tell the audience is you see guys on the weekend, Tiger Woods, the greatest player ever. And these guys, they are nervous. They just know how to control their emotions. They are so nervous. You can't believe it. But they're controlling their emotions. And it's exciting to get in that position. I mean, the adrenaline's flowing, and you always hear guys hitting 9-iron from 175, and it's all adrenaline. They just know how to control the adrenaline better than some guys.
Let's go ahead. 1 year later, 1995 at the U.S. Open at Shinnecock, you're hanging around par after the first two rounds and had a tough third round, but in the final round, you shoot the round of the day, course record 65, and includes a back nine 29, which is another U.S. Open record. Talk us through birdieing six of the final nine holes.
Well, it's crazy. I mean, I was playing with Fuzzy, and we're going around on the front nine, and we're one of the earlier groups out in the day, and you know, we're just off, and we get to the back nine, and I snap hook it off of 10, and the best I can do is get it in the front bunker upside the green. Well, I get it in the bunker, and I get it up and down, and then I don't even know what holds a birdie, but I know that I made four putts probably over 50 feet. And Fuzzy said he could just feel that they were going to start going in after. I made two in a row from 40 feet. And then I think I'll never forget on the 15th hole, I had a putt, must have been 75 feet. And I hit it, and it was in from the time I hit it. And I was like, oh, man, this is something. But the most hilarious thing about the first one is John Daly is playing in front of me. He hit it in the bleachers left on 18 Shinnecock. Johnny Miller's first telecast. My caddy's from Canada, and he's smoking a cigarette, and I'm in the fairway, and I have no idea I'm breaking these records. And I'm standing there, and I look at my caddy, and he has smoked that cigarette all the way down past the butt, and he is shaking. And I said, Kenny, what's wrong with you? And he said, And he said, if you par this hole, you're going to break every U.S. Open record they got and set the course record at Shinnecock. And I said, well, I didn't need to know that. So anyway, John Daly's up there, and he's taking a drop out of the bleachers. Well, they finally finished the hole. Well, now I'm really nervous. I hit it long and left over the green, and Johnny Miller, first telecast, says, well, he can't get this ball within 20 feet of the hole. I flopped it up high as you've ever seen, and it rolled down there about 3.5 feet, left to right putt, and I made it, shot 29, walked off. And what was great about that is my dad was there.
Wow.
You know, they came up, and you know, it was Father's Day, because the open usually finishes on Father's Day. And I was like, so anyway, I walk in, I shoot 65. They're saying, Neil, you need to hang around. You can win the tournament. There's 23 groups behind me. And sure enough, I think I finished fourth, and Corey finished one under. I might have finished two or three over, but that was a great experience there, too. And then something about all the major championships I always played in, I always did real well. I was a golfer. The harder it was, the better I played. And I think it was because you had, you know, like back to, you had to visualize everything. So anyway, like you said, the next year we go to Oakland Hills, and I'm not playing real well. It's raining. I'm 10 over for the tournament with 9 holes left on Friday. My dad and his buddies are up there, and they said, we're going home. We'll see you tomorrow. So they get in the car and start driving back. Well, anyway, same scenario. Snap, hook it off the tee, get it in the front bunker, get it up and down. Birdie the next hole, go to a par five. We are playing lift, clean, and place. It's a dog leg right, 12th hole, and nobody's getting home in two. Well, I hit it out there, and it plugged in the fairway, so I picked it up and put it on the plug mark and hit a driver over the trees, and it plugged a foot from the hole. So anyway, I chip in on the 15th hole, and I got an eight to ten footer on 17 to get to 28 per side. But anyway, I didn't make it. I go to 18 and I hit it short of the green, and I chipped it up. And I made about a 6 footer downhill left to right to shoot 29 again. And I'm like, oh boy, I went from missing the cut to I think 14th place going into Saturday. And the funniest thing is my dad and them were halfway home, and they said, you want us to turn around and come back? And I'm like, well, obviously you're bad luck, Dad. Keep going home. But, you know, it was I always did good. I mean, the U.S. Senior Open one time, I played well in that, and I flew one in the hole for a hole in one. I've done some incredible things in the U.S. Opens. But, you know, it is what it is, and I like it. The harder it gets in the worst conditions, that's my kind of golf.
Yeah, so is that what it is for you with U.S. Open? Because there's probably no tougher tournament all year round than the U.S. Open. The conditions, the mental part of the game, all that sort of stuff, it seems like that brought out the best in you.
Well, I've always had a very upright swing. And, you know, I always took the approach going into the U.S. Open. The rough's always deep. I mean, the rough. Back, the rough on the tour now, and the way the game's changed, the rough, the fairways are 60 yards wide. When we played back in the day, we always had rough. Hartford, Connecticut, Greensboro, up in Greensboro, some of the toughest rough. He couldn't move the ball 80 yards out of. And I always took the approach in the U.S. Open that everybody's going to be driving in the road, in the rough, and everybody needs to be the best from 80 yards in, because we're all going to be hacking it out of the rough, getting it up there. So basically, at that time, my wedge game and my putting was all those weeks. And that's what you need in the U.S. Open. It's all about adversity. You better grind it out. There's no 22-under, 21-under. If you hung around par back then, that something good was going to be happening to you at the end of the week. And I think I was a grinder.
And Neil, you played full-time on the PGA Tour from 1990 to 2005. And you go back through Q School in 2009. I know you had some shoulder issues at times during your career, but is that why you ended up going back through Q School in 2009?
Well, after that many years, I had a shoulder injury. I had a lot of foam in my shoulder the size of your fist, and I needed to get that removed. I had 3 ruptured discs in my neck and probably didn't really know what was wrong with me. I had so many injuries going on. But like I said, I was a grinder. I was tough. I was going to whatever it took, I was going to do it. And when I went back to tour school, I got through and went back out. And, I'm the kind of guy, I'm a golfer, man. I play for the love of the game. That's what I do. I play golf. That's all I've ever done. And so when I got through and went back out, I played all right. And then I actually made a mistake. I had a shoulder surgery, and I thought I was going to go back out and be fully exempt. From what I understood, and they changed the rules a little bit, and I went back out and was not fully exempt. I was in the top. I think I finished like 4th at tour school. So I was going to get into, some pretty good tournaments early in the year. Well, I went and had surgery where I should have probably played the first 4 tournaments and then had surgery because I moved down the list. So then I was out for about 2 or 3 years with just, I was letting myself heal up. And then when I got 48, I'm like, I got to go back or I'm never going to go back. And I went back and rehabbed on the web.com a few times. And I feel like today I played better than I played back in my prime. The ball goes further. Chris, when I was a rookie on the tour, Tom Daly, me went out at the same time. He led driving distance at 284. Dan Poe was like 282. And I was 279 and was 3rd in driving distance. And when I was 51 years old, I played enough tournaments on the big tour for them to keep stats. I hit 301 and was 62nd.
Wow.
So that goes to show you, it's the equipment. I'm not getting stronger over 20 years. But I hit the ball 23, 27 yards further at 51 than I did in my prime. So that's golfing.
Yeah, and I want to talk about that because, to your point, I saw at the Shaw Charity Classic out on the Champions Tour earlier this year, you played out there, you had a 349-yard drive. So distance isn't an issue for you. I'm surprised we're not seeing you out there all the time. When are we going to get to see you more on the Champions Tour?
I'm trying. I couldn't get through tour school, but 2 years I shot 15-under 1 year and missed by one. In 1 year I shot 14-under and missed by one. They only take 5 out of tour school. But, I've always been an advocate. I played 20 years on the tour and have no status when I turned 50 on the Champions Tour. I had status on the Corn Ferry Tour and didn't have any on the Champions Tour. And I'm like, something's not right here. But, I had limited status on the regular tour. But I'm trying to Monday qualify some. I feel like I can play. But, when you get out there, you got to do a Stephen Offer. You got to get hot. He went on a stretch. He's probably the best player in the world for about 6 months last year. But I'm trying, and I'm going to go qualify some. And I'm going to play in the SAS Championship up in Cary, my home tournament, in the end of October. But I want to play out there, but it takes $23 million in career earnings to get on the Champions Tour. $23 million. So it's kind of a close shop. Unless you had to have a great career to get out there. 5 wins or $23 million, and I didn't do that. I just had 360 cuts. But it is what it is. But sometimes you got to help yourself. I'm playing better. I've been struggling with my putter a little bit, but it's coming around. I'm working at it. I feel like I still got some good years in me. I'm turning 60 next week, but I still feel like I can go out and compete. I'm hitting the ball good as I've ever hit the ball, and I think actually the equipment's helped me. But, I'm just not putting like I used to, but who does? Nobody stays hot forever.
Right. Neil, before I let you go, let our listeners know, how can we stay up to date with the things you're doing and follow you, whether it's online or it's on social media?
Well, actually, I'm not on social media much. I'm getting ready to launch my website, and I'm coming up with that. I'm waiting for the heat to cool down, and I'm going to give some lessons, and I'm going to try to play the tour some. And actually, I'd like to say hello to my wife and kids. I got a great support system, my wife Ashley, and I have an 11-year-old and an 8-year-old, two girls, and they're probably the greatest thing. No, not probably. They are definitely the greatest thing that's ever happened. And we wanted to do it that way. When my career slowed down a little bit, that was the time for us to have children, and they're a big part of my life, and they really support me, and they're excited to see me play.
Well, Neil, I'm excited to see you play again soon, too. I hope we get the privilege of watching you out on the Champions Tour and then getting to have you back on the show again. A lot more to talk about your playing career, but you've made this segment a lot of fun. I hope we get to catch up with you soon.
Anytime, Chris, if you ever need anything, need any help, you just give old Neil Lancaster a call. I'll be here, buddy.
I appreciate you, Neil. Take care, my friend. All the best to you and your family. Happy birthday a week early. Look forward to catching up soon.
Thank you, sir.
See you, Neil. That is the great Neil Lancaster. Folks, you want to talk about a great player that was doing some great things out on the tour back in the 90s. Boy, you talk about Neil Lancaster. 29 twice? Almost shot a 28 at a U.S. Open? Are you kidding me? That never happened, obviously. Such a course record 65 at Shinnecock, and then goes out and also shoots 29, and he does it back-to-back years. Never happened in the history of the game. May never happen again, particularly at a U.S. Open. And then a guy that was right there, in those Opens, finishing fourth one time, and then he got a win at the Byron Nelson. And then one of the things we didn't discuss, just a couple of years ago, 2018, at the Barbasol Championship, at the age of 56, he's right in the thick of things. I mean, he shot opening round 69 in the first and then the second round at 56 years old playing with the young kids. I think this guy's got a lot of game left, and I'm very much excited to see how that plays out for him, hopefully, like I say, real soon. Okay, before I get to my next guest, Julie Inkster, I want to remind you about a couple of our sponsors, starting with our friends over at Adele Golf. Is your driver adjustable? Of course it is. How about your irons? Didn't think so. Adele's new SMS irons give you adjustability in an iron to match your swing. These new irons come with three weights lined up across the back of the club. By moving the heavy weight to the heel, center, or toe location, you can match the club to your swing instead of vice versa. The result? Total control of the club face for more distance and accuracy. Your irons can't do this. Check them out online by going to adelgolf.com. I also want to give a shout out to our friends over at Squares Golf. Are you like me, always considering new golf equipment? Maybe a new driver? Well, let me reset your thinking because I discovered Squares Golf Shoes. The patented Squares Toe provides balance, stability, and a wider base for increased connection to the ground, effectively increasing your swing speed by 2.2 miles per hour and an average of 9 yards of distance. Independent testing proves it. That's right. It's proven in science. Go to squares.com. Get the Squares 30-day money-back guarantee and use promo code DISTANCE to get $20 off. Remember, distance comes from swing speed, and swing speed comes from your connection to the ground. Squares, the distance golf shoe. Okay, now next on the tee with me is seven-time major champion Julie Inkster. Let me give you some background on Julie. She's from Santa Cruz, California, played her college golf at San Jose State, where she was a three-time All-American from 1979 to 1982. During her college career, she won a remarkable 17 times. In 1982, she was named the San Jose State Athlete of the Year, and she also won the Broderick Award for being the women's number one college golfer in the country. Julie is a member of the San Jose State Sports Hall of Fame. She became only the second player in history to capture three straight U.S. Women's Amateur Championships. She did so from 1980 to 1982. She turned pro in 1983 and captured her first LPGA title that year at the Safeco Classic. She'd win there again in 1988. She was named the Rookie of the Year in 1983. 1984 was her first full season out on the LPGA Tour, and she would win two majors that season. She'd go on to win 31 times on the LPGA Tour, including seven majors. She has 45 total professional wins and 149 career top tens. She was named the 1999 Female Player of the Year by the Golf Writers Association. In 2000, she won the ESPY Award for Outstanding Women's Golf Performer of the Year after having won the Women's PGA and U.S. Opens. She was inducted into the World Golf Hall of Fame in 2000 as well. She played on nine Solheim Cup teams. In 2011, she became the oldest player and first playing assistant captain in Solheim Cup history. She's been the U.S. team captain three times, winning two of those. She's won four times so far out on the Legends Tour. She's become a wonderful broadcaster, commentating for the Golf Channel and Fox Sports, and I am thrilled she is with me tonight here on Next on the Tee. Hey, Julie, thanks for coming on the show.
Chris, thanks for having me. I've heard so much about your podcast and your show, and I'm just happy to be aboard.
Well, I appreciate it very much. Thank you for being here. So, Julie, as I read off all of those incredible things that you have achieved so far over the course of your career, and there's only a few women out in the game that have achieved as many majors and wins and that sort of thing. I mean, you should be on the Mount Rushmore of the LPGA Tour. Do you ever give yourself an opportunity just to sort of sit back in your quiet moments and kind of soak it all in and think, man, that's a heck of a career?
Yeah, especially, you know, just kind of falling into golf. I didn't really start till I was 15 and got a job working at the golf course, picking up the range and parking carts, and just got some clubs from the back room and started playing, and I just fell in love with the game, and I still am in love with the game. I've had a long career, and I think in order to have a career like that, you got to have a passion for the game, and I definitely have a passion for the game. It's given me way more than I've given it. So, I'm very happy with my career. I mean, I never dreamed of being a professional golfer, and then to have a career like I have and have a family and stuff, it's been an amazing ride.
And Julie, to your point, like I read that, you know, you ran track, you were on the swim team, you played softball, basketball, tennis. How did golf find its sort of way in for that passion to start to bloom when you had all those other things that you were such a great, well-rounded athlete doing as a kid?
Well, I think they call that a jock, but yes, I was definitely a jock. I had two older brothers and they were very athletic. My dad played professional baseball for 3 years in the Cincinnati Reds organization, and we were just a sports family, and so I kind of followed my brothers around. And then when I got a job at the golf course, it really gave me something to do that they weren't interested in. It's kind of my own shtick, and I just I didn't mind being by myself. I thought it was very peaceful-like. So I got, you know, a bunch of clubs from the back room, none of them matched, but I started playing. There was a guy there at the club named Grant Rogers. He was kind of gave me some lessons, and then we just played. We didn't stand on the range and beat balls. We just learned how to shape shots and hit shots, and I always had a good work ethic. I probably one of the rare people that liked to practice, so it was never work for me.
And Julie, I read that you played on the boys' high school team at Harbor High, and you and the team won some local tournaments. What was it like for you being out there playing on the boys' team?
Well, it was a win-win. I mean, I was the only girl in the whole community right there that played on the golf team. I played on the JV team my sophomore year. And then I actually made varsity my junior and senior year and played pretty well. The other visiting teams really didn't like to compete against the girl, and that kind of inspired me to play hard and to try to show them that girls can play golf too. But really, it was a guy named Floyd Slider. He was the golf coach, and for some reason, he found out that I was starting to play golf, and he called my parents and asked them if do you think Julie would be interested in going out for the golf team. And it was during basketball season, which was really my first love. Basketball practices were always in the evening, so I could do both. So I did both, basketball is still my still a great love of mine, but golf really took over, and I was able to get a partial scholarship my freshman year at San Jose State, made All-American, and then kind of took off from there.
Yeah, Julie, talk about your time at San Jose State and teaming with Patty Sheehan. You won 17 tournaments during your time there. She won 5 times. I mean, the other players must have known they weren't even playing for second place. They were playing for third when your team bus pulled up and you guys opened the door and walked out.
You know, San Jose State was really the best thing that ever happened to me. Because I really didn't have any competition. I didn't play in a lot of tournaments. You know, the first time I ever played out of the state was I qualified for the U.S. Open at 18 at Indianapolis Country Club. And, that kind of spurred me to think that, I would like to play golf in college and be a great collegiate player. But, we had a great coach named Mark Gale, who really didn't know much about golf. He was a retired Colonel Air Force, Colonel in the Air Force, but he was an amazing fundraiser, and we got to play in all the best tournaments and compete against the best collegiate amateurs players in the country, and that really helped my game to really feel like where I needed to go and what I needed to do to improve. And I was dating my husband at the time, and he was in Santa Cruz, and so it was just a really good fit for me. San Jose State was a great women's college program, and I was 35 minutes from home, and so I could go back and forth. So it was a really great spot for me to really improve my game and play against the best collegiate players.
And Julie, earlier this year, San Jose State's women's golf team beat top-seeded Stanford at the Julie Inkster Spartan Invitational. What's it like having a tournament named in your honor? Didn't have your alma mater win it.
It was great. You know, Stanford is by far, the number one ranked school in the country. But San Jose State had a great team last year, and I think they ended up fifth. But, I got a lot of admiration for Stanford and San Jose State. They go head-to-head a lot, and Stanford usually beats up on us. But it was great for them to come out on top and maybe give them a little bit of satisfaction of beating Stanford for once.
Julie, I want to fast forward all the way to 1999 because you came into the U.S. Open that year. You're 38 years old. You're searching for your first U.S. Open title. And not only did you get it, you set the record for the lowest total to par, finishing 16 under. You win that going away. How satisfying a week was that for you?
Well, being an American, you always want to win your national championship. And I always loved USGA events. I mean, I grew up at a golf course in Santa Cruz called Pasatiempo, which is a really tough golf course. And very U.S. Open-like, a lot of undulation. And it's an old Alistair McKenzie golf course, kind of a hidden gem. So I always kind of played USGA events well, winning 3 U.S. amateurs. But I just could never figure out the U.S. Open. I think I just wanted it too much. And I was having a really good year coming in to the U.S. Open in Jackson, Mississippi at Old Waverly. And I remember driving in, and a lot of things, I can't remember a lot of things, but for some reason I remember this. I said, you know what, if you're ever going to win a U.S. Open, this is the time to do it. You're playing well. You got no excuses. You just got to go out and do it. And, you know, I was hitting the ball very well that week. I gave myself a lot of chances, made some putts, and I just got on a great roll.
And, Julie, I always like to kind of get inside the minds of great players. And the last hole of that tournament, you had a great drive right down the middle of the fairway. You've got a five-stroke lead going into that, I believe, into that, you know, final hole. You've got your last shot left. It's the green is right behind a pond. You've got room to the right if you needed to lay up or to bail out to the right. But instead, you take that aim and the ball lands a couple of feet from the hole and releases a little bit. Take me through the mind of that shot. Instead of, you know, conservative, play it safe. I could double bogey here, still win. You go right for it. Talk about that.
Well, I mean, I had so much confidence in my irons that week. I hit my irons so well. And if you know my background at all, I'm not one to lay up. I always play aggressive. It's probably cost me a few tournaments, but it's kind of like a little challenge for me. If that pin's tucked back there, or the whole location's tucked back there, I know I can get that little white golf ball, just snuggle it right up there. So I always played aggressive, and you know, I think when you're feeling it and you got a five-shot lead, you know, I have to say it never crossed my mind that I was going to hit it in the water. You know, it crossed my mind that I was trying to make birdie. So I think that's the kind of the mindset you have to have.
And Julie, after you hit that shot and you're walking up the fairway, the camera's on you. And you look into the camera and you say to your kids, you know, mommy's going to bring home a trophy, a really big trophy. Talk about,
yeah.
You know, kind of being able to just sort of, you know, relax and, you know, let your head down, if you will, and be able to have that nice little comment for your kids as you're strolling up the last hole of the U.S. Open.
Yeah, they were 9 and 5 at the time. You know, it was a week I went by myself just so I could kind of focus on, you know, golf that week. And Brian, my husband, flew in on Sunday for the final round. But, you know, it was just kind of a monkey off my back. I mean, who wins an Open at 39? I mean, it's really rare to do that. I never really doubted myself that I wouldn't win one, but my window was shutting very fast. And to be able to win it at 39 and share it with my family, and my kids knew what I did. It's, you know, different from their friend's mom's work, but you know, they knew I played golf and my living, and that's how I made my money. And they knew I had a passion for it, and to be able to show them, you know, hard work and persistence. Sometimes it just doesn't happen right away, but if you stick to it, maybe good things happen.
Julie, you captained 3 Solheim Cup teams, and you were the winning captain in 2 of those. Where do those 2 wins rank for you amongst all the other great achievements that you've had so far?
I think being the Solheim Cup captain is, I think winning the Bobby Jones Award this year was probably the icing on the cake. You know, it's not only just for your record in golf, but for, you know, how you handled yourself during your career and how you give back to golf. And I think that was probably, you know, my highlight of my career. But probably right below it is being a captain for a Solheim Cup team. You know who you are as a player, but you just don't know how or who you're going to be as a leader. And, you know, I have a huge passion for the Solheim Cup, for America. And, you know, I wanted to do it the right way. And it was just great to see how my team really responded and really played hard for me. You know, you can't put a trophy or price tag on the dinners and the camaraderie. And
in that first year that you captained the team, 2015, you guys start the final round down 10-6, thanks to some shenanigans that finished up the matches from the previous day. But talk about what it was like and how, you know, all the things that unfolded that finished up with the four ball event and the drama that, that led into the singles matches and ultimately an unbelievable comeback victory for the U.S. team.
Yeah, I mean, it was an unfortunate thing because, you know, you never want, you know, confrontation to ruin the spirit of the game. I don't think that's how it should be played, but we did have a little bit of a rules controversy that I wasn't really happy about, and my team wasn't happy about, and it happens to be that the European team wasn't too happy about it either. But, you know, we had to come out early on Sunday and finish those couple matches, and, you know, we were way down, but I saw a little fire in my team, fire in their eyes that, you know, we're going to do this. And I loved our matchup, the way we matched up individually in the single matches. And our first few, you know, got the points, and the way we kind of spread it around, and, you know, kind of the unsung hero was Darina Piller, you know, making that putt on 17 or 18. Excuse me, to really push us, because if she misses that, then we lose the cup. But, yeah, it was a great celebration that night. It was unbelievable. And then we followed that up by going to Oktoberfest. So I'm not sure I still have recovered from that.
Julie, just a couple more before I let you go. You created the Julie Inkster Senior Award for players so they won't turn pro until they complete their college degree. Talk about why that's so important to you.
Well, the way the LPGA qualifying is structured, that if you're in college, you can go to the LPGA qualifying school as an amateur, and if you don't get your card, you can go back. But if you get your card, we were seeing a lot of seniors leaving their team in the fall of their last year, and leaving their teammates and their college and their coach kind of hanging because they weren't able to redo that scholarship. So I wanted to develop an award that would maybe keep these kids for that extra semester to finish their contract with their school and their teammates. And Workday has been great. They have helped me establish this award, and Workday gives them $50,000 to start their LPGA career. They get two exemptions into LPGA tournaments. They get a couple days with me and mentorship. You know, we go out and play golf, and then you know, I just I'm really hands on. So my first two previous winners, I talk to them a lot, and it happens this year. Natasha Andreun from San Jose State won the award. So, you know, the first two, one was from Furman, one was from Duke, and now we have a Spartan. So it's really been a great, great for me to mentor these kids and to get them started on their career. But it's also been great for the schools because it keeps them in the school for another semester. Golf's going to always be there, but to be able to finish and have a chance at a national championship with your team, you only get that 4 years of your life. So, so it was big. It was something I wanted to do, and Workday really helped me sponsor it.
Julie, I've had the privilege of having Tom Pertzer on the show several times. He's become a wonderful friend, and you guys were paired together and you won the mixed team championship back in 1986. Tom's named one of his daughters in your honor. Talk about winning that mixed team championship with Tom and your relationship with he and the family.
Please don't tell him I didn't say that was the greatest accomplishment of my career, because he's going to be disappointed. No, Tom and I, it was, so Tom's just a little bit older than I am, and his agent, we had a tournament called the JCPenney Classic, which they need to bring back. where a PGA pro and an LPGA player play 4 days. You play an alternate shot, a best ball, and Tom called me and asked me if I'd play with him. And I knew Tom. I knew of Tom Pertzer, but I didn't really know him. And we just developed the greatest friendship. I think we played for 12 years straight. And we did finally win it 1 year. But he's become one of my best friends ever. And, you know, Tom has just got the biggest heart in the world. He can't make a decision, but he's got a great heart. He would come out to me. He'd come out and say, so wear the red vest or the blue vest? I go, Tom, let's go red today. All right, red. Okay, hit the 5-iron or the little 6? Tom, hit the big 6, you know? So, but we have a great relationship. You know, we see each other at least once or twice a year. I got to meet all his kids, for his, 70th birthday, last winter. And, so it's been a great ride and it's a friendship you treasure. And I can not talk to him for a couple, you know, months and just pick up right where we left off. So to me, that's a golden friendship.
Have you forgiven him for missing that 2-foot putt on 18 that would have broken the scoring record in the mixed team championship?
So, you know, that is so Tom Pertzer. He doesn't talk about us winning and all the shots and all the places I put him in that he was hitting shots out of and getting them on the green. He remembers that one putt. I mean, I basically gave it to him, but they told him to putt it, so he putt it. But you know what? I tapped in that 2-incher to say, I think he wanted to give me the glory.
No doubt. Julie, before I let you go, let our listeners know, how can we stay up to date with all the great things you're doing, whether it's following you online or it's on social media?
Well, I'm on Instagram at Julie Inkster. I'm starting my Julie Inkster Foundation, a Julie Inkster Award. So go there and give me a few hits.
Well, Julie, it's been a huge thrill having you as part of the show tonight. I hope we get the privilege of having you come back and share more of your stories and inspirations with us. You're fantastic.
Thanks for having me on.
Thank you.
Okay.
Take care, Julie.
Bye-bye.
Bye. That is the great Julie Inkster, folks. You want to talk about one of the greatest players in the history of the game. You just heard from her. I mean, 7 major championships. She's 6th all-time in majors on the LPGA Tour. She won 31 times. She's won everything that you could possibly win. She's in the World Golf Hall of Fame. She's been the Player of the Year. She's won 3 amateur titles. I mean, you look at everything that Julia has achieved over the course of her playing career, it just doesn't get much better. And she's a wonderful human being on top of that. So I'm completely honored that she was a part of the show tonight, and I hope we get the privilege of having her back on the show again soon. Before I get to my next guest, Chris Finn, I want to remind you about a couple of more of our sponsors, starting with our friends over at Srixon Cleveland Golf. Your best performance starts with the right golf ball at Srixon. A global leader in golf ball technology and innovation, Srixon offers a wide variety of award-winning golf balls for golfers of every skill level. Whether you're searching for a tour performance golf ball or a distance golf ball with incredible feel, Srixon provides the best golf balls at incredible prices. Srixon offers a wide variety of personalized options while also developing a highly visible colored golf ball as well. Select the right golf ball for your game today and trust it with Srixon. Check them out online at srixon.com. Srixon.com. Find the right golf ball for your game today. I also want to remind you about our friends over at Sun Mountain. There's a company nestled in the valley of Missoula, Montana that embodies the essence of quality, function, and innovation, and that's Sun Mountain, which started building golf bags back in 1981. They are an industry leader in golf bags, travel covers, outerwear, and push carts. With flagship products that you've come to know, like the C130 cart bag, the 2.5 ultralight stand bag, the Club Glider travel cover, the Speed Cart, and Rainflex rain gear, Sun Mountain continues its quest to provide the very best in golf products to every range of golfer. Visit them online at sunmountaingolf.com to look at their amazing product. Okay, now back in Next on the Tee with me is Par for Success founder Chris Finn. Par for Success is a golf fitness and physical therapy company located up in Morrisville, North Carolina. They've got a great facility up there, folks. They can help you with improving your golf performance, and if something hurts when you play, they can help alleviate that as well. Chris is a licensed physical therapist, a certified strength and conditioning specialist. He is also Titleist Performance Institute certified and a certified nutrition coach. He's grown Par for Success from being a physical therapy business that he did out of the back of his car to becoming a tremendously successful business, one that Goldman Sachs has recognized as a small business poised for growth. And I'm excited he is back with me again tonight here on Next on the Tee. Hey, Chris, thanks for coming back on the show.
Oh, my pleasure, Chris. Excited to be back with you. How you doing tonight?
I'm fantastic, Chris. Catch us up, my friend. It's been a minute since we got to have you here. Catch us up with what's going on with you guys.
Yeah, it's been a lot going on. We're actually in the midst. We're building a state-of-the-art brand new facility that'll be 2-3 times the size of what we got right now. And we've done a ton. I've been doing a ton of research with ground reaction forces. So we have a bunch of research grade force plates, and really just, you know, since the last time I was on, it's just been, I joke with everybody, you know, that we work with and everyone, you know, on our team, it's kind of been just like a constant flow of gasoline on a fire, and it just keeps getting bigger and bigger. And even the next studies and everything we look at just continues to build on everything that we've been able, you know, that we had done in the past. So it's been a wild ride. Obviously we started with a local business. With COVID, it definitely was a bit of a forcing function where people were looking for ways to, you know, continue to work on their bodies. Obviously, golf did nothing but get bigger. Well, people had a lot of time working remotely and whatnot. And so it really, you know, the virtual side of our business and then being able to connect with golfers at this point, pretty much on most continents and helping them, you know, get the right information about what they need to do to, you know, to play the game longer, you know, to, you know, whether it's getting out of pain, hitting the ball further. Just being more consistent. It's been a wild couple of years here. So, I'm excited to be back with you and chat, you know, about, you know, a number of different things.
So, Chris, you talked about studies. You know, in our game now, everything is about distance. It's about club head speed. Yep. Talk about what overspeed training is and the studies that you guys have done with respect to that.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, I think, you know, overspeed has definitely gotten, you know, and there's a lot of, you know, speed training devices and systems out there. And, I think overspeed training is definitely one of the more popular mainstream ones where, you know, you see a lot of guys on tour, different sticks and, you know, different weighted sticks and swinging them faster. And basically, you know, when we're looking at gaining speed, the way I always break it down for people is there's four kind of areas. One, you can obviously get more technically efficient. You know, two, you can get the right equipment. That often helps. Three, you can, you know, get more mobile, you know, get more mobile and be able to get from point A to point B. And then the fourth quadrant is the physical side of power and speed. And that's where kind of overspeed training really fits. And it's the analogy I always use. It's kind of like we've all driven the golf cart at a local muni course that, you know, just slows down when it goes down the hill, right? Like defies gravity, like that should go faster. That's because there's a governor on it. And as golfers, we all have governors on our body. Our brains will put this governor where, you know, say you're swinging 95 miles an hour and your body says, hey, if you cross 100, you're going to break. It'll apply kind of, in a sense, that little downhill break where it's going to kind of almost force you to sit at that mid-90s level. So what overspeed training does, it's kind of like taking the governor off that golf cart, and then all of a sudden it unlocks, you know, more speed. So there, when we talk about gaining speed, overspeed training could be, you know, I would call it the holy grail for a number of golfers to access new, you know, speed immediately. It does come with a cautionary tale, unfortunately, from what we've seen in all the research we've done. You know, at this point, we're getting close to 6,000 golfers that we've kind of run through the studies. And really what we're seeing is there's kind of three profiles of golfers, Chris. And if you're in the one profile, which we call a more RPM under the hood golfer, basically a golfer who's just raring to go, they have great mobility, they can rotate where they need to, they're really strong, meaning they can support the speed that they currently have and even a little bit more. Those are the golfers where overspeed training is like, holy cow, it's like like an explosion. We had one guy who was, he was probably mid-30s. He was 6'7". He played Division I basketball. He jumped 40 inches. He could throw up one of the, do some med ball testing and whatnot to see kind of what golfers' power elements are. And these are all tests people can do at home too, which is the cool part. But he threw that ball like 50 feet. Like his numbers were out, like out of this world. He's super mobile. He's 6'7". He's 32. Any guesses how fast he came in swinging?
120.
That's what you would think, right? He came in swinging 101 miles an hour, right? So that's when you look at a guy like that, overspeed training, and what we've done on our studies, he fits the profile where overspeed training and basically taking lighter clubs than your, you know, than your driver and swinging them really fast. There's, you know, certain protocols that you do. And, you know, basically in 10 minutes, we got him from 101-ish, I think it was one, somewhere to 101, 103, up to 127, right?
Wow.
So it was, and it was incredible. But, you know, the cautionary tale that I always tell everyone is everyone hears that, like, oh my gosh, you know, they Google overspeed and they got it ordered to ship in their cart, right? Get, you know, overnight delivery. The one cautionary tale, unfortunately, is 95% of golfers, particularly over the age of, you know, 40, don't fit that profile. We actually will fit the, we call the ticking time bomb grouping, which is, you know, we don't have mobility in one of the four major rotary centers. And if that's the case, and then we try to go really fast, the chances of injury are incredibly high. Basically, we did a study where we looked at probably close to 100 golfers who got hurt doing overspeed training. And every single one of them failed at least one of the main four rotary centers. So unfortunately, while overspeed training can be the holy grail, most golfers, unless they've been working on their bodies and, you know, and know the right areas to train, are actually the complete wrong people to utilize it initially. Now, you do the right mobility training, you know, 3-4 weeks, you know, maybe 8 weeks in worst case scenarios, all of a sudden you can pass the mobility test. Now you've done the prerequisite. Well, now overspeed training can be incredibly valuable. So it's a really cool tool that we can use of basically getting your brain to remove the governor from you so you can actually go really fast. It's an immediate access to speed, but used in the wrong situation with the wrong person, it actually can get a non-desirable impact of, you know, injury or, you know, something along those lines. So use with caution to everyone listening.
Yeah, so to that end, Kristen, and you're right, because we become, you know, overly enthusiastic, like, wow, I can jump, I can be just like that guy. I can get 26 yeah. miles an hour in 5 minutes. And now all of a sudden yep. I'm going to be driving the ball 300 yards. I'm assuming you sort of got to put the governor on some of us, right? So that we mm-hmm. don't go out too fast and end up with back injuries or leg injuries and that sort of thing. How do you temper people down from wanting, I don't want to go from A to B. I want to, you know, go right to Z. How do you keep us yeah. from actually doing that damage to ourselves?
Yeah. So, you know, one nice thing is the brain is the body is pretty good at generally, you know, trying to protect us as much as possible. The group of golfers who you're talking about are single digit golfers. So those are guys, remember we started talking about, you can kind of gain speed in four different, you know, called four quadrants of speed. You got the one piece of the pie of speed is kind of the physical where we've been talking, and others the mobility. The other two are technique and equipment. And so really, if like good players, people who maybe played collegially or, you know, been scratched for a while, technique and equipment is generally optimized. And we actually see a lot of golfers who can create club head speed faster than what their body's able to support physically. We have a home assessment that we give everybody. It's free. And anybody listening, we can talk about that later. But in the assessment, you can figure out, you know, are you too fast, quote unquote, for what your body can handle or not? Or are you in a good position to go after it? But it's using that assessment, Chris, is really where we kind of, I would call it the litmus test to really kind of helping people very clearly, you know, say, hey, did you pass all the four mobility tests? If you didn't, do not pass go. We're going to take a couple of weeks. We're going to make sure we pass these tests. And then we're going to look at, okay, now you're mobile. Now are your strength and power numbers at a point where you can support more speed than you currently have? And so you kind of have to check those two boxes. Number one, can you rotate? Number two, do you have enough strength and speed to safely add more? In which case, you know, green light, let's go. We're going to do, you know, there's, you know, whether it's overspeed training, whether it's, power, golf specific power training, whatever, ends up being discovered as kind of the main avenue that you need to go, then we go down that road. But so really the number one way that we keep people or try to keep people from trying to skip, B through, Y is basically kind of really being real with them, saying, hey, do you end up in the educational piece of saying, hey, do this test, your hip's cramping and you're like, can't move more than 10 degrees. That's not good. That's a red flag. Does that make sense to you? And so it's really kind of being giving people the education, allowing them to go through those tests at home. And the cool thing is you can, golfers can retest themselves. They're doing some stuff, they're working, 2 weeks later, retest. Did you get any better? Great. You're better. Let's move on to the next level. So really the biggest thing, it's a lot of education. And I'm going to be honest with you, Chris. As you know, most golfers, they don't always listen until they show up with their back or wrist or elbow hurting. And then they say, you go, hey, remember when we talked about that? And they go, no, I don't remember that at all. I don't want to talk about it. Okay.
Right. So Chris, talk about overspeed training and how overspeed training compares to just sort of regular traditional strength and conditioning training. How are those two things either alike or very different?
Yeah, a great question, Chris. So, and this is a super common question a lot of golfers have. I think a lot of golfers will mistake them for being interchangeable, if that makes sense. So someone say, oh, I'm going to do my golf workout and I'm going to get stronger for golf. Oh, cool. What are you doing? They go, oh, I'm doing overspeed training, right? So an overspeed training, just for everyone listening, basically what it consists of is there's a couple different ways to do it. The most effective way we have found with all the research we've done is basically taking a club about 5% lighter than your driver. If you're listed, probably like a 5 wood. But if you're a club geek and you can weigh your club, 5% is the exact actual measurement that we found. And then basically what you do is you're going to swing it as hard as you can to your dominant side. So, if you're right-handed, swinging towards your left. If you're left-handed, swinging towards your right. Swing as hard as you can 3 times, toward the dominant, towards your strong side, swinging 3 times as hard as you can. Towards your trail side. Each of those 3 rounds, you're doing 5 swings each. So in total, you got, basically 3 sets of, 5 left, 5 right, you'd rest, 5 left, 5 right, rest. So 30 total swings. So basically doing that 3 times a week as hard as you can. So you're obviously that club is going to be going faster than how you would swing it when you'd normally be playing. Doing that 2 to 3 times a week, the key is you take about a 2 minute break in between each of those sets of 10 swings. 5 left, 5 right. That's what overspeed training that we found has the, most impactful, improvement in terms of swing club head speed improvement. So that is what it's actually called nervous system training. So it's getting your brain to take the governor off and allow your body to go faster. So that is very different than what you would like if you go to the gym and you're lifting weights or you're doing jump training or plyometrics or anything along those lines. Lifting weights is more building the muscular strength up to support the nervous system moving faster. So I would say when you go to the gym, I'd use the analogy of you're basically building your brakes up. When you do your overspeed training, you're trying to put more cylinders into the engine. So where a lot of golfers get in trouble is they want a 12-cylinder engine, but they are totally cool having the rusted old Toyota Corolla brake pads. until they crash the car because the brakes don't work, and then they say, oh, now I get why I need to get stronger. That's how I would describe kind of just visually for everyone listening is overspeed training is basically trying to get as fast as you can with what you got. Maybe if you can find another cylinder or two there. The strength conditioning or like the weightlifting, and this doesn't need to be what we found in our research is if you can do 90 minutes a week, spread it out 90 minutes over the course of a week, you can be significant gains. That's really kind of building the braking system and the support system so that you don't get hurt and so that you can actually utilize safely what the actual what the overspeed training is designed to do and when it can be beneficial for you.
So if we're working out and building our muscle over 90 minutes over the course of a week, how often should we be doing overspeed training?
So that was one of the big interesting findings we found, Chris, is a lot of the what I would call mainstream companies out there doing a lot of the, selling speed training systems and whatnot. they were recommending like up to 100 swings in a session, and, you know, 3 to 5 times a week. Like, you could do it multiple, like way too much. So the ideal that we found in all of our research, we tested all of the golfers in the studies only did it twice a week, and that you always have at least 24 hours in between sessions. But if you're only doing it twice a week, ideally, if you can have 2 to 3 days in between, that gives your nervous system the most chance to recover. So you're 100% fresh, so you can go 100% in each of those training sessions. So it's kind of crazy for people to think of it of, you know, I only got to swing 30 times as hard as I can twice a week. That's what the research found. We compared doing that versus doing 100 swings, you know, more than that, 3 times, 4 times a week. There is a point of diminishing return. It would kind of be like telling Usain Bolt or a 100-meter championship, 100-meter sprinter to go run 100-meter sprints like 5 times a week. Like, that's silly. Like, that nobody trains like that. So that's kind of what we were telling our golfers to do. Looking at the science and physiology of it all, that's where the fun thing we find is the more research we do, we find golfers can get much more focused on the stuff they actually need themselves specifically, and they can actually do less of it, which I tend to meet fewer gym rats that are golfers than not. So most golfers don't mind having to spend less time in the gym, more time on the golf course.
Right. Chris, you guys also did a study on eccentric flywheel training. Talk about what that is.
Yeah, so it's definitely not mainstream. That's definitely one thing it is. So what it is the reason we got to that, this is one of the cool studies. We did a 2-year study looking, we probably mentioned this in great detail last time we chatted, but, you know, the gist of it was we looked at adult golfers and we looked at, kids, and we looked at different, there's two main types of training. One is, if you think of traditional weight training, if you have let's take a squat, for example, and you squat down, that lowering part is called the eccentric motion. That'd be the equivalent of kind of the backswing in the golf swing. Kind of muscles are stretching, right? Then there's a pause at the bottom of the squat, similar to the transition point in the golf swing. That's the isometric phase. And then the final phase, the third phase of movement, is concentric, and that would be the standing up of the squat or the downswing. That's when everything kind of shortens and explodes and you exert all the force. So what we found was that adult golfers, when we put them in a type of program which focused a lot on the eccentric phase training, the specific in the study was called triphasic training, they saw, if we looked at the average gain, club head speed gains that we saw in adult golfers, they saw a 60% improvement on top of that average gain. So it was a massive improvement when we trained them that way. So put it in raw numbers for people, it was like an extra 5 yards in 3 months. By training differently. So putting the same amount of work, just doing it a little bit differently, saw significant improvements. So then what we did off of that is we said there's a type of, I'm sure everybody's familiar with like a cable machine. You know, people will do chop exercises, rotary exercises, rotational exercises on them. When you look at those, let's say you put like adjust the weight to the, 30 pounds, and you pull it out, you have 30 pounds resistance. When you go back, they're still that same 30 pounds, right? Gravity is equal the whole time. What a flywheel machine is, and especially with, the pandemic, and you can buy these for your home gyms and put them in. They're very, very affordable and very, when I tell you that the results, people will understand why I'm advocating for them. Basically, when you pull out, let's say you pull out, instead of having the, adjusting the weight on the machine and you have 30 pounds the whole way, it's a wheel. And basically, as you pull the pulley, the wheel, it spins the wheel. And so the harder you pull, the faster the wheel spins. So the harder you pull out, the caveat is now that wheel has to spin back the other way to ravel the pulley back in. And when it does so, it actually pulls harder. So when you pull out, that's that concentric phase, or like think of the downswing. And then it's training basically the backswing type movement or the eccentric motion to be stronger. And so it's a more specific way. So if you think of golf as a rotary sport, it's a way to train specific rotation with the same way of training that we found gave golfers, that 60% extra gain in a 3-month period. And when we did that, we saw over double the club head speed gains. So that's where we've started to see. So that's where I say, everyone at home, Google eccentric flywheel training, see if you can find one for your house. You know, there's tons of different machines and companies and brands, but that's really, what we've found is, you know, so when we can say, hey, the reason we say 90 minutes is because we know, you know, the eccentric motion, are we looking at training, getting that rotational side stronger? And do you have the motion? So do you have the motion to rotate, and are you stronger in that rotational motion? You can do a lot fewer exercises and see a lot better results than spending, you know, I know we have some guys that come in, they spend 90 minutes a day in the gym doing the same routine for the last, you know, 10 years. You switch them up and you say, hey, let's do not like, you know, 2 hours a week, maybe, and just do these things. They look at you like you're like, don't know what the heck you're talking about. And you got three heads, and they come back and they're like, oh my gosh, I have way more energy. I can play way more golf because I'm not in the gym so much. I feel better. And hey, the ball's going further too. Is that supposed to happen? But yeah, that definitely is.
And Chris, we've seen lots of players now. You mentioned medicine balls a little while ago. We see them throwing medicine balls off the wall to build strength and speed. You guys looked at that as well, and jumps and medicine ball chest presses and all that sort of stuff. Talk about the study you did with those.
Yeah, so we're nerds, in case you haven't figured that out, Chris. We just do studies all day. but basically what we do is, you know, we look at, like, basically look, we're kind of like trolls on social. We look and say, all right, what's everybody doing? What does the average golfer think works? And then we go and we look in the, you know, all the research and say, all right, is there actually any research that says it works? And then if there isn't, or if the research we find is pretty bad, which in the most case in the golf space is very bad, you know, then we go and we set up these studies and we actually run them because we're curious and we want to see what the answer is. So, you know, obviously if you go on any, you know, golf fitness or any of the pro golfers, you'll see them throwing the medicine balls, like you said. And so we were like, well, does that actually work? Like, how do we actually know that that works? So we took we've got about 100 members at our facility in Morrisville in person. So we do all these studies with our in-person members. And we basically, we lovingly call them our lab rats because we control everything, and we set up their, you know, their programs. And we had one group who was just doing medicine ball work, and we had another group who didn't do any medicine ball work. All they did was train. We know that upper body push power. So think of, like, if you're doing like sitting on a chair and, taking a medicine ball and doing kind of throwing a chest pass, throwing the ball, that sort of motion, or like a bench press sort of motion. That motion or that power or strength in that direction, as well as vertical leap. So your ability to think of how high you can jump. So like a squat or a deadlift type motion, those produce, if we get real geeky into ground forces, those produce vertical forces. Those are the two that have a statistically significant impact in club head speed. Meaning we know that if we get those two motions stronger, more powerful, club head speed should go up. So what we did is, so we had one group who just trained, excuse me, the no medicine balls, but just trained push power and vertical leap power. The other group did kind of traditional strength training, and then they did all the medicine ball training. So that was the only difference between the two groups. It was one group did medicine balls and the other group did the power training for push, upper body push and jumps. And at the end, I think we sent you the study, so you already know the answer, but most people, when you ask them, you say, hey, so which group, which group you think did better? I made the mistake of sending you the answers ahead of time, but yeah, everybody says medicine balls. Oh yeah, medicine ball. Definitely. It's rotational. Gotta get stronger. When we looked at the data, medicine balls got no faster, like zero. Like they're really like compared to the lower body explosive power, the upper body explosive power, the medicine balls did nothing. So if we're trying to, this is, I think, a huge takeaway for everybody listening. If you're trying to get stronger for golf or trying to get faster for golf, number one, don't throw medicine balls. but number two, most importantly, assess yourself. You know, you can do an assessment, figure out, do you have the mobility? Do you have the strength to support, you know, the speed that you say that you want? And then let's figure out the best way for you to actually get it so you're not wasting your time. Now where we did find medicine balls, and where we do find them and where we use them on a regular basis is if people have good mobility, if people's strength and power numbers are good, but their speed is low, Overspeed training is one way, avenue we will go. The other is we will actually use medicine balls to help people get the feel of how to sequence using the ground correctly. So medicine balls are a great tool for helping people sequence ground reaction forces in terms of horizontal. There's, side to side force, there's up and down force, and there's rotary force. And in traditional golf instruction, because video has been the technology that's been most accessible for people, the people take videos of their swing and they say, hey, look at my swing, and oh, my hips didn't clear there, or, my shoulders are back. Well, what comes before all of that is none of that happens unless you use the ground. So if you use the ground correctly and you have good mobility, you should see the correct positions happening. That's called kinematics. Kinetics is what we see in the ground. So the hip should go first, torso, arms, hand, club, that's kinematics. Kinetics is you should push toward the target, and there should be a rotary force, and there should be a vertical force at specific times in the downswing. And that drives the positions that we can see on video. So that's been the really cool thing that we've been able to find is we say, hey, we are no longer using medicine balls with the idea that we think we're getting faster because no, that doesn't work. But if in the specific case where a golfer has good mobility, that we know they're strong as heck, but they just can't figure out how to put it all together, we've come up with a name, we call it transfer training. And then we'll use the medicine balls to help them transfer all the gains that they've made physically to actually be able to put it into, the correct sequence that they use in the golf swing. So anyone who's about to just throw their medicine ball away or burn it, you can keep it. But just make sure we're using it in the right time, right place.
Yeah. And Chris, you talked here in this last bit about using ground forces correctly. And we're hearing a lot more about that in the golf swing over the last few years than we ever heard, at least in my lifetime, using the ground to help propel your swing. Talk about how we can go about using the ground forces properly.
Yeah, so first thing is you drop $50,000 and get dual force plates. No, I'm kidding. that's only what crazy people like me do. But I think one of the reasons we're hearing more about it, Chris, to your point is, they used to be like, $100,000. Like they were only available in like, university research lab settings, right? The technology is getting cheaper, so it's becoming more accessible. So now we're getting crazy people like me who are doing, running thousands of people through them and trying to figure them out. And I think that's where you're starting to see it's becoming a little bit more mainstream is we're starting to see the real connection between, hey, when the guys, when the golfer's in all those correct positions, if we look at like a 3D kinematic graph and the hips went first and like it's an efficient swing, well, there's the same sort of mapping of efficiency that we should see in how somebody uses the ground. There's exact ratios. There's timings of those ratios. I think one of my favorite examples is he's 20, a 21-year-old who's playing one of the local universities, high-level Division I, big, very successful amateur golfer. He swings about 100 and, he's like 118, I think. So high teens, 118, 119 miles an hour. We have a 59-year-old guy, member, who is not a very successful golfer, probably like a 10 handicap, maybe high singles. Both of them produce the same exact amount of force. We measure them on the ground, on the force plates. So they're both producing the same amount of force. But the 59-year-old swings, he's 101. He just crested over 100. You sit there scratching your head and you're like, well, wait a minute. I thought someone was stronger and they put more force on the ground, then the club should go faster, right? So then you actually look at when the timing of it happens, and the 21-year-old, he's applying that amount of force, before his lead arm is parallel on the downswing. So basically between top of backswing and right before P5, right? The 59-year-old, who's almost 20 miles an hour slower, guess when he applies that force?
On the backswing?
After he hit the golf ball.
It's actually
after he's hit the golf ball. So he hits the golf ball, and then he finally stands up. And it's because he doesn't have, or historically, he had very bad hip rotation problems on his lead leg. So he wouldn't clear his hip. Now that he has that hip rotation, he doesn't know how the heck to use it. So he still has that bad habit of applying all that force after he's hit the golf ball. So that's where it's the cool stuff. The cool thing about ground reaction forces is as you understand them, it's like cheating. It literally is like cheating, Chris. You can change, you know, with high-level golfers, you can be like, hey, we just need a little bit more force here. And it's like immediately, boom, speed goes up. Or if you want to change a launch, you can change launch angles. It's incredible what can happen by the understanding of how your body and how your feet are using the ground, and the impact that it then has on body movement. And then ultimately, obviously, that's going to impact, you know, club characteristics and whatnot. But I think that's why we're hearing more about ground reaction forces. I think for the average golfer listening right now, I will tell you from our stats, 75 to 80% of you don't even pass the mobility tests, which at that, like, don't even worry about ground reaction forces, because you're not going to be able to produce correct ground reaction forces if you don't, you know, if you can't move, right? So it's kind of like you said, ground reaction forces are the new sexy thing. That's Z, right? Let's focus on A, which is can we move? Can we get from point A to point B? Great. Now, are we strong enough to, you know, to actually support those movements and do them repeatedly and safely and actually support faster speeds? And then if we can do that, then it's a matter of, then it's the fun stuff that we see on social media. Overspeed training, and, you know, the story I told of the guy, he went from 101 to 127 or whatever it was, right? Like, those are the cool marketing, the headline grabbers. Those are less than 5%. You know, 95% of us have really basic low-hanging fruit that with 90 minutes a week, you know, if you do more, it goes quicker, but 90 minutes a week at least of just doing the right stuff can make a massive difference in terms of the longevity in the game, playing, you know, into your 80s, beyond, and maintaining that level, you know, even, you know, if you're a high level amateur or collegiate player, maintaining it, you know, into your 40s, 50s, and older. And actually, this is a fun stat that I did not share with you yet, Chris. If you had to guess, what is the age at which the body starts rebelling and Father Time, like, we see all of clubhead speed start dropping? Any guesses?
Clubhead speed starts to drop at 40.
Very good. 41 is the actual number. But
wow.
Yeah, 41.
What's that?
It's actually funny. You see everything sort of climbing, and then there's just this massive cliff at 41. Something terrible happens to the human body at 41. We haven't figured that one out yet. But it's just at 41, it's like, oh my gosh. So you feel bad for all those, the PGA and, you know, pros, you know, and they hit their like early 40s and they're just waiting for 50 for the senior tour. Like, it's like, oh, we know why.
Indeed. Chris, before I let you go, you've talked about the mobility test. How can we go out there on your site and learn about it, read about it, and actually do it?
Yeah, for sure. So we actually put together a page for all the listeners. People want to go to par4success, par4success.com/next. And you guys can just, you know, put your email in so we can send it to you. We send it over to them. It takes probably 7 minutes to go through the mobility test. You'll be able to see how you compare clubhead speed-wise to other golfers your age from our database. And then if anyone's interested, we also offer a free call with our golf fitness guys, so you can jump on. They can kind of, you can tell them how you did. They'll tell you what it means and kind of give you an idea of some stuff that you guys can start to work on. But par4success.com/next, and you know, use it to see where you're at now. And I can't stress enough, reuse it every month. Just, you know, continue to monitor your body, particularly if you're playing a bunch. And then obviously we're getting into the fall and winter's coming around the corner. It's just a great tool to use. And, you know, our hope is that as many people as possible grab it and use it as a resource to, you know, for the right information, to hopefully play the game as long as everybody would like to.
And Chris, before I let you go, let our listeners know, not just all about what we can find on your website, but then how can we stay up to date with all the great things that you guys are putting out there, whether it's on social media, and you've got a great YouTube channel as well.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. I mean, it's just at par4success on pretty much everything. So, Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, YouTube. We put out content new content I've released every week on YouTube, tons of educational stuff. We'll tend to leak some of the research a little bit there too. So that's probably YouTube is probably the best place, to stay up to date with kind of the latest and greatest that we're coming out with, from a research standpoint. But it's just par4success, PAR, the number 4 success. People can find us any of those platforms.
Chris, I can't thank you enough for coming back and being a part of the show again tonight. Hopefully we get to have you back on a little quicker next time around. But you're awesome, my friend. The things that you guys are doing, we hope we get to catch up with you again soon.
I appreciate it. It's always a pleasure, Chris. We'll talk to you soon.
You bet. Take care, Chris. That is the great Chris Finn. Again, par4success.com is the website. You put in par4success.com/next, and you'll be able to go through and take those mobility tests, see where you're at. I mean, to Chris's great point at the end there, fall and winter's coming, right? So we're not going to be out on the golf course quite as much as we would like, and for some of us, not at all. But let's stay in shape over that time. Let's get our bodies right. Let's see where we are from a mobility test standpoint and then keep testing ourselves. And again, the YouTube channel is fantastic, folks. So many great stretches and exercises and drills that you can do out there to get your body in shape. And like we say, you know, clubhead speed's king nowadays, gets us more distance. Let's find out how we're doing. Let's unlock some of that. And Chris is giving it to you for free. Why not do it? Again, par4success.com/next. We'll catch up with Chris again sometime here, hopefully very soon. Okay, before I close up shop tonight, I want to remind you about a couple of more of our sponsors, starting with our friends over at 2-Under. 2-Under Men's Performance Briefs have just released their new Spring and Summer 22 collections with fun, new, and exciting prints like the Freedom 2 and 3, Santa Fe, Tigers, Zebras, and Duckies. And their new exclusive Folds of Honor collection, where they donate 20% of all Folds of Honor sales proceeds to that cause. The patented Joey Pouch technology delivers maximum comfort, fit, and performance while preventing any unwanted skin-on-skin contact or chafing. Good for anything from the golf course, to the boardroom, to the bedroom. You can find these 2-Under performance briefs in over 4,000 golf pro shops nationwide, all Shields sports stores, all PGA Tour superstores, Golf Galaxy, Dillard's, and other fine retailers near you. You can also order them online at 2under.com. That's the number 2UNDR.com. 2-Under, performance in your pants. Use code NEXTTEE20, that's NXTTEE20, for a 20% discount on the 2-Under website. I also want to give a shout out to our friends over at Golf Pride. We deal with a lot on the golf course, whether you're teeing off in front of a crowd, hitting a 4-iron after a rain delay, trying to figure out wind direction, or second-guessing club selection. It's easy for your mind to race. That's exactly what drove Golf Pride to create the all-new CPX. It's made with a unique EXO diamond quilted pattern, reducing vibration in your hands on every shot. The EX diamond quilted pattern really helps your hands sink into the club on every shot, giving you maximum comfort, because when your hands are comfortable, you're comfortable. CPX is available now on golfpride.com or at your local retailer. All right, my friends, it is time for me to put a bow on this episode of Next on the Tee. I want to send out my sincere thanks again to Neil Lancaster, Julie Inkster, and Chris Finn for joining me tonight. Scheduled to join me next week are our resident director of instruction, Tom Patcher, will be back with us. We'll get a return visit from Allison Fillmore, vice president of development for the PGA Tour. And Brenda Calcavecchia, Mark's wife, caddy, and much funnier follow on Twitter, will be here as well. Looking forward to having Brenda as part of the show. So it's going to be a great one, folks. I hope you'll come back and be a part of the show with us. You can listen to this show as a podcast on just about every major podcast app out there. We're on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, Audioboom, Player.fm, Podbean. Folks, if you've got a favorite podcasting app, we're probably on that one too. Just type in Next on the Tee in the search bar. You'll probably find us on there as well. Please check out our website, nextonthetee.net, to stay up to date with what our guest schedule looks like. Plus, we give you links back to recent episodes and individual guest segments. So whether you've got 20 minutes or 2 hours, we've got great content on there available for you. Folks, I can't thank you enough for choosing to listen to this show again tonight. I know you've got a lot of great podcasts out there to choose from. I am very thankful that you continue to make Next on the Tee one of them. Until next week, hit 'em straight, my friends.
When you think boots, you think Ariat. You think comfort from day one and durability to day 1,000. You think steel toes on the job, square toes on the dance floor, with style that owns a Saturday night and still looks sharp enough for Sunday dinner. And through every mile and every moment, you're thinking Ariat boots. Boots that show up, stand out, turn bad ideas into better stories, and still punch the clock come Monday morning. Now, it's time to stop thinking and start shopping. Find your Ariat boots at Ariat.com or a retailer near you.
Okay, it's kind of embarrassing how bad I am at budgeting.
Let me see your charges.
Fine.
You spent over $600 on takeout last month.
I can't cook. You know this.
Yes, I have had your disgusting food, but you're literally paying for a meal subscription on top of that.
Whoa, wait. That can't be right.
Look, just get Rocket Money. It shows you all of your expenses in one place and even tracks your subscriptions. And if there's a subscription you don't want, which for you, there are a lot you don't need, you can just cancel right in the app with a few taps.
So you mean I don't have to call anyone to cancel?
Nope. No hold times or anything. And they'll even try to get you a refund on some of the months of wasted money, which is a lot of money for you.
Okay.
And if you thought I was done, I'm not. The app can also help you make a budget that works for your income. Anytime you get close to your spending limits, it alerts you, so you know exactly where your money is going at all times.
All right, I'm in. What do I have to do?
Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel or download the app from the Apple or Google Play stores.